The Second World War, a podcast by Stephen Bedard.
Well, I'm really excited about this episode of the podcast. I am pleased to say that we have Dr. Jason Bell with us, who is the author of a great book called Cracking the Nazi Code, which actually was a Christmas present from my wife. She saw this at the bookstore and knew of my love for military history, and especially military history that intersects with Canada. And so knowing me so well, she made sure to get it. And I plowed through this book because it was so interesting. And it was about things that I really hadn't thought about. So, Jason, I'm so thankful that you're here, and was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you encountered Winthrop Bell, and any relation, if any, and also what drew you to his story.
Sure. So I'm an associate professor of philosophy at the University of New Brunswick. And over the last couple of decades, my work has specialized in two philosophical movements, one called American Pragmatism and the other called German Phenomenology. And it, around the year 2008, I was very interested in how these movements interacted historically because they share quite a bit in common. And so I made a fact-finding trip to Germany where phenomenology was founded and where some of the pragmatists studied. And that's where I found Winthrop Bell's doctoral dissertation that he had written between 1912 and 1914 that interpreted the pragmatists to the phenomenologists. So Winthrop Bell was the missing link between those movements. So that's what initially excited me by this, was a pure academic philosophical story. But the copy of Winthrop Bell's dissertation in Germany was missing two pages. And I found that his papers were being held in Mount Allison University in New Brunswick under restriction. So I wrote to the president of the university and asked for permission for those restrictions to be lifted so that I could go in and research these papers. And at that time, I had no idea why these papers were being held under restriction. Of course, you know, there can be all kinds of reasons, family reasons or business reasons, et cetera. So I did not even have a hypothesis about what was going on. But the president agreed to lift the restrictions. And I went in and soon found out that Winthrop Bell had been doing intelligence work for the Canadian and British governments at a high level. So this included personally briefing the Canadian Prime Minister Robert Borden and the UK Prime Minister David Lloyd George. But for me, that was just kind of an interesting footnote for a while. So I spent a few years just working on the philosophical implications of Winthrop Bell's work. But then around the year 2012, I started reading his intelligence reports and was astounded to see that he was the first enemy of the Nazis as an intelligence agent working in Germany. So I've been working on the implications of that since then. As for the coincidence and surname, it's a complete coincidence. So Winthrop and I are not related other than by philosophical interest of pragmatism and phenomenology.
Well, interesting how you found him, and I think that helps explain why a philosophy professor is writing a book on someone who was involved in military intelligence, because people might not see that connection right away, but that absolutely makes sense. Now, I was wondering if you could give us a short outline of what was happening in Germany. We have November 11th, 1918, the ceasefire, hostilities stop. But what is happening in Germany at that time, just in those next few years?
So the next few years after the armistice, So basically what had happened is November 11th, 1918 is seen as being this cessation of hostilities. But it turns out this was only the cessation of explosions. So the Allies kept up their food blockade of Germany. It had killed, after the armistice up until the spring of 1919, the food blockade killed something like a quarter of a million Germans through starvation and related diseases. And this, of course, the bulk of the suffering was being directed at, you know, poor people, particularly the urban working poor. So the militants who had fought World War One and had really pushed this war through propaganda and through lies to the German people, the people who had enriched themselves, the industrialists, etc., these were not the people who were suffering. Many of them fled to neutral nations, places like Sweden, and they were living it up. So it was the poor people who had nothing to do with causing the war who were the ones who were really suffering. And so Winthrop Bell's reports to Britain in March of 1919 and February, March of 1919 helped to lift that food blockade, which gave some breathing room to German democracy. So what had happened towards the end of the war, there was a long struggle between the militarists who were fighting the war and lying about German chances of success and Germany's budding democracy. So towards in the last months of the war, the major opposition parties, beginning with the communists and then the social democrats and the conservatives, banded together to overthrow the militarist government. And so the new pro-democratic government that came in November 1918 was very friendly towards Britain, Canada, and America. They had quite a bit of animosity still towards France, but they wanted to become a full-fledged democracy. And so these years after World War One, that group, the Democrats, were pushing for this new model, democratic governance, friendliness to the West. But over time, they became systematically weakened because of these endemic problems, hunger, inflation, massive debt that was occurring. It was so bad, actually, by the fall of 1918, by the fall of 1919, Winthrop Bell's intelligence reports were saying that extremist military organizations were the strongest forces in the country, and that democracy at that point was only surviving because the militarists did not yet want to take over the country because the economic condition was so miserable. They wanted to wait until things got better before they took over. So that was the point at which Winthrop Bell said if Britain and the West did not act immediately to support Germany, that the democratic experiment would end in failure.
So things were obviously very, very difficult. People are dying. The political situation is very, very difficult. In the midst of this, what was happening in terms of anti-Semitism? Because sometimes people think that, Germany was just kind of going along, and then this monster Adolf Hitler shows up with some radical anti-Semitic ideas and makes people follow his view, and he just kind of turned the country that way. But in your book, you indicate that there was a lot going on already, even before Hitler came to prominence.
That's correct. So German anti-Semitism, it was a much older phenomenon. So for instance, the German philosopher Nietzsche, writing in the late 1800s, at one point claimed he had never met a German who was not anti-Semitic. So there was a history of race massacres in the country. And of course, this was not just a German problem. This was had been a problem throughout Europe, anti-Semitism. But so it was very common. And again, Nietzsche in the late 1800s said that if you wanted to save Germany, you'd need to line up all the anti-Semites and shoot them. So this was long before Hitler. When Hitler was a young artist in Vienna and a young soldier, he was a voracious reader, And he was reading a lot of tracts that were coming out of universities with, written by professors and things like that, that were vicious anti-Semitic tracts. So it was a real problem. Winthrop Bell already in 1918 was saying, in his intelligence reports, was saying that anti-Semitism in Germany was far more severe than it was, for instance, in England. So in England, you'd kind of find a more, wouldn't want to call it benevolent, but it was kind of more of just a sense of cultural superiority. We're better, but without any, accompanying talk of, Jews being racial enemies or anything like this. So there was a whole strange theology connected to this that was being developed in the late 1800s about the good, pure, white northern gods fighting a war against the bad, evil, dark-skinned gods. And then along comes Charles Darwin, who has an innocent theory of genetic selection. And then these racists decide that what this means is that only one human race is going to survive, and that it's going to survive by killing off the other ones. So it became a paranoid kind of us versus them notion already in the late 1800s. So this was in kind of this theological, scientific, quasi-scientific language, not yet a political language about white skin needing people needing to survive and needing to kill dark skin people for this to happen, or else the reverse would happen and the dark-skinned people would win. So Hitler comes in and he's mapping on to this, kind of deranged paranoid tradition when he's a young guy. Now, Winthrop also, during his very first intelligence reports to Canada and Britain, this is in November and December of 1918, he says that this group of race warriors had seized control of Germany during the latter part of World War I. So in the beginning of the war, it was German political nationalists along with these racists who were fighting the war. But as the war went on, Winthrop Bell said the racist nationalists seized control of the country and were fighting World War I as a race war. So this was a bit of a surprise for me to see, especially in light of what came after. But this is all happening when Adolf Hitler is utterly insignificant figure in the German military. So a private and then a corporal, first fighting on the front and then running messages. He's not a player at all as this group under the head of General Erich Ludendorff, who was a real racist. He hated Jews and he hated Slavs. As that group took over the country and Ludendorff became the dictator of Germany towards the end of World War I. So Winthrop Bell says that Ludendorff had set up all of these unofficial organizations under his own personal authority. Meanwhile, the official ruler of Germany was kind of a clueless about this and wanted to just enjoy himself. So Ludendorff was able to effectively seize control of the country. And then my book maps out a meeting that happens in 1915 under the control of an unnamed general who was almost certainly Erich Ludendorff. There wouldn't have been anybody else in position who would have had the authority to do what was then done. But it was to, in 1915, announce an intention to fight a second world war after the current one was completed. And in fact, it would begin the day World War I ended. And the next world war was going to be a world war against the Jews. So then we have seen historical evidence over the next years of Erich Ludendorff supporting through propaganda and through intelligence gathering and through recruiting the group of people who were going to fight this this next world war against the Jews. So Winthrop Bell hears and sees the signs of this while he was in a German prison camp during World War I. He didn't yet know who the actors were who were controlling this. But his first intelligence reports were saying that there was this concerted race war effort going on during World War One. So he had his eye on it. But he also said in his personal briefings to, for instance, Canadian Prime Minister Robert Borden, that that group of race warriors, as of the of the end of World War One, had become politically marginalized. So many of them had fled to neutral nations. They were extremely unpopular because the German people had basically, right up until the end of the war, they had been completely convinced that Germany was winning the war because of propaganda was constantly telling them that victory was just days away. And so, of course, when Germany lost, they realized the whole thing had been lies and a delusion. So they hated Ludendorff and his leading officers. Ludendorff flees to Sweden quickly is working on a comeback. But personally, he's been discredited, even though he still has this powerful organization in place. So Winthrop, through his reports in 1919, tracks this racist group growing in strength. And then starting in the summer of 1919, he notices that this has gone from the shadows to out in the open. So Jews are being attacked on the streets systematically throughout Germany. Businesses are being targeted. And it's really what Kristallnacht that we know from the 1930s. It's of course the famous event when Jewish businesses and Jews were attacked throughout Germany with Hitler's stamp of approval. But it turns out this was all going on much, much earlier in the summer of 1919. It was just that people didn't notice it then because there were not foreign journalists there, because the world was dealing with a lot of other problems at that moment. So these systematic attacks against the Jews in the summer of 1919 were going on under the radar, except for Winthrop Bell's reports about this. So Bell, as a Reuters reporter, which was his cover as an intelligence agent, was publishing warnings about this throughout the English-speaking world, about these attacks going on, but also about a systematic propaganda, so anti-Jewish messages being placed on unsigned posters that were going up throughout the streets of Germany. And then finally, by the end of summer 1918, by the end of the summer of 1919, these posters were bearing the simple message, kill the Jews. So this was a genocidal propaganda. And that forms the backdrop of the kind of intelligence, the military intelligence atmosphere among these extremist groups in Germany that recruited Hitler into the movement. So Hitler was recruited by these people and heavily supported in 1919, and that's really why Hitler was able to make such quick headway. He was part of a team far extended his own personal charismatic powers. He was being supported by funding, but also by military toughs who would go out and beat up the people who were the enemies of this right wing group. So I think that really explains Winthrop Bell's intelligence. Really explains how it is that Hitler was able to have the rapid impact that he was in a disorganized country that was hungry and facing hyperinflation and serious political problems.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. So we have been talking about Winthrop Bell, and we've said a number of things about him. So we've talked about how you discovered him looking at his thesis, and that he was studying philosophy in Germany, and he was in Germany during World War One. And then we find afterwards he's been sending reports, and he's been doing military intelligence. Could you share a little bit of how he got into this this area? Because going from being a philosophy student and a philosophy professor to being a spy is not always a straightforward jump. So if you could share a little bit about that and what exactly his role is, because I think sometimes people have a Hollywood idea of what a spy looks like. And so I'm suspecting he doesn't have secret gadgets and a real fancy car or anything like that, but I'll let you fill in the gaps.
Sure. So he was, you know, kind of accidentally training himself to be a spy, not intentionally at all. So his intention was to be a philosophy professor at Harvard when he went to Germany to study with Edmund Husserl, the founder of phenomenology. Now, a couple of things were setting him up to be a spy, even despite his intention. So one of them was the year that Winthrop showed up in Germany was during a time of crisis between Germany and the Western powers, meaning at that point, France and Britain mainly. America was still a bit on the sidelines, but they kind of were a little bit more inclined towards the British and the French side. But Germany had announced their intention to build a navy to rival Britain's and to seize their own share of the world empire. So what this meant is they went in very aggressively. They committed the first genocide of the 20th century in southwestern Africa. And World War I almost started 4 years before it did when German warships had their guns pointed at French and British warships in a war that quite nearly started in Morocco. So calmer heads prevailed, although there was unfortunately a lot of racism built into it. So the Africans were given, excuse me, parts of Africa were given to the Germans as a concession. But nobody was quite happy about what had happened, and nations began rapidly rearming. So this is the run up to World War I. So that's when Winthrop Bell shows up in Germany, and later on when he was arrested by the Germans when World War I broke out, everything really looked like he had been sent in as a spy at that point. But in fact, it was totally innocent at that moment. He really had gone into Germany for his philosophy work. So these tensions keep on rising, 1910, 1911, 1912, 1913, until they finally break out in 1914, when Winthrop Bell is arrested and sent to prison. But to backtrack a little bit, so Winthrop Bell had been trained in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick before he went to his graduate studies in philosophy. He'd been trained in math and physics. And then when he was in Göttingen, which was Germany's leading university in the maths and physics in particular, he befriended a lot of these leading thinkers in these movements. So these would have been at the graduate student level and at the postdoctoral level, even some young professors. When World War I broke out, his friends were recruited into German military intelligence, including into important and sensitive positions. His friends were pro-democrats. They were liberal in the classical sense of liberalism. They admired democracy. And so during the closing months of World War I, they were visiting Winthrop Bell in prison and giving him a privileged perspective on what had happened in the war, including towards the end of the war, showing him highly classified secret cables that were describing the democratic takeover of the country. So at this point of the war, Britain, Winthrop Bell was literally in the whole world, the best informed English speaker about the internal situation in Germany because of his access to these secret cables. So when the World War I ended, Winthrop Bell went to London, fully intending to hop on a ship, get back to Canada, visit his family, and then begin his professorship at Harvard. But in London, he met with the Canadian Prime Minister, Robert Borden, who was a friend of Winthrop's father's. To all appearances, this was just an innocent meeting. It was just Robert checking in on Winthrop. But then Winthrop gave him this portrait of what was happening in Germany, And Borden was astounded because Winthrop knew all of these things that prime ministers did not know. Germany was really a black box at that moment. So Robert Borden asked Winthrop to cancel his tickets to Canada while he worked on getting Winthrop this intelligence position. And that was complicated because a whole lot of different signatures were required. Canadian citizens at that moment were British subjects. So you needed to both get the North American ambassador to sign off on this. You also needed the British authorities to sign off on this in the Foreign Office and MI6. There were some hiccups along the way. At one point, Winthrop was offered a kind of a desk analyst position, which he refused. He said he'd only consider delaying his return to Canada if he could go back into Germany. And then the other key thing was to find money to hire him. So Britain at that moment was quickly trying to get rid of expenditures to try to get Britain out of the massive debt that they had incurred during World War I. So MI6 and British intelligence was nearly bankrupt at that moment and was needing to fire a lot of its intelligence agents. So what ended up happening is Canada fronted the money for Winthrop L's salary. It was routed to MI6, who would actually pay the bills, but the bulk of the funding was coming from Canada. So as for what this looked like in terms of the gadgets and the rest of it, so Winthrop received MI6 training. So he would have known how the gadgets worked and how invisible ink worked and hand to hand combat and the rest of it, but for his own safety and for the safety of the mission, he really went in barehanded. So his cover let him do this. His cover was as a Reuters reporter. So he was sending out telegraphs that through the public telegraph in the first months because there was simply no alternative to simply just being able to get this out through public lines. So if he had been carrying a gun or anything else and he'd been arrested and searched, that would have given him away as a spy. So paradoxically, he was safer unarmed than he would have been armed. Later in the year, when the British military mission, so military intelligence specialists came into Berlin and actually set up at a hotel right next to Winthrop's hotel, then Winthrop gained access to more secure forms of encrypted communication. So that would have been the kind of spy gear that he had, so to speak. So later in the year, he was able, for instance, later in 1919, he was able to reveal the names of his sources, whereas in the beginning of the year he could only kind of just indicate position. So he would have been too dangerous to actually list these names, and that would have gotten people killed. So transportation, he would get by on foot, or he would get taxi cabs. So there were not Aston Martins yet.
Too bad for him.
Yeah, that's right.
So you might have already answered this a bit, but what do you think made Winthrop so effective? Because he's not a professional intelligence agent. He has received some training, but there seems to be something about him that he does an excellent job. And the people are people above him are recognizing that he's doing an excellent job, even if they're not fully prepared to follow through on his recommendations. They at least recognize that he is providing value. So what made him so effective?
Sure. Well, I think a lot of this goes back to his upbringing and his training in Nova Scotia. So he was from a very, very, very hardworking family. And they were well-educated and well-mannered. So many of these stereotypes of what East what Canadians and in particular East Coast Canadians are like nowadays, it was the same when Winthrop was growing up. So ready to lend a helping hand and being good listeners, hard. That was Winthrop. So he was an excellent conversationalist, and he was a good friend. And so these people who eventually became intelligence officers in the German military trusted him long before they had those positions. They knew what he was like. They loved him. They knew that they could trust their lives to him. And so this was really the reason why they were willing to share information with him and then to introduce him to their own contacts. So he quickly gained even more powerful contacts within the German political system. And everybody had the sense that he was really looking out for their interests. And I think this is a key aspect of intelligence that maybe people don't usually think about. We think of, James Bond versus the bad guys, but we don't think as much about how intelligence, agents, in order to do their work, need to be able to cultivate sources in potentially unfriendly regimes, with this notion that the sources, the foreign sources and the domestic agents, need to trust each other. They both need to be committed to, good government, and things like this. And so Winthrop had a mental map and a friendship map of these sources in Germany who were taking these great risks to inform him of what was going on. And they needed to trust each other with their lives. So I think that was something that Winthrop Bell already knew how to do before he was an intelligence agent. But he was able to then switch that skill set to being an effective intelligence agent. And then I should say something about his training in phenomenology, in philosophical phenomenology. So this is the a philosophical art of describing intentions, so ideal or logical intentions without bias. So Winthrop is leaving his own biases aside. He had certain political predilections, etc. But he knew that he needed to leave these aside in order to just accurately describe what was going on. So phenomenology has been called the art of faithful description. This sounds really easy, but it turns out in practice, this is really difficult because intelligence agents can go in with a kind of bias about what they're supposed to be doing. And what that looked like for a lot of these people going into Europe, there was kind of an anti-German bias. So these are the nasty Huns that we need to punish to teach them a lesson. And then there was another bias that we need to go into Germany to prevent communism from taking over. So a lot of these British agents who are going in, like that's what they think their job is to get rid of communism. Winthrop, by contrast, was trying to just analyze scientifically what was going on. And his reports that are going back to Britain are saying, well, the militant communists are here. They're real. But they're utterly marginalized. People don't like them. The public doesn't like them. The military doesn't like them. Politicians don't like them. They're producing an act of propaganda, which, of course, British intelligence was reading, which made them look like they were a really powerful group. But Winthrop was saying, if you understand the whole context, you'll understand that's not the case. So I think that's what he was really bringing to the table, was this massive understanding of the whole German context. So what was going on, theologically, politically, what the people on the street were saying, just kind of what everybody was thinking, in order to see the relative strengths, for instance, of democracy, of the communists, and of the of these racist reactionaries in the country. As for how this was being received, so actually MI6 was totally smitten with these reports. So they were totally convinced by what Winthrop Bell was saying. And you can see him convincing the other intelligence officers who came in of the same thing. So the racist faction of the German military really wanted to convince Britain that they, this militant faction, even though they were illegally arming themselves in contravention of the Versailles Treaty rules, that Britain should kind of wink and let them do this because they were going to fight the communists. And Winthrop was able to convince MI6 and his fellow military intelligence agents in Britain that this was a lie, that the communists were not a real force, and that these reactionary militants, the racists, were the real danger to the country. So MI6 was absolutely supportive of this, and you can tell this because of the people that Winthrop Bell was meeting. So the head of MI6, Sir Mansfield Smith Cumming, would send Bell to advise prime ministers about this, which is a clear indication that they thought he had a valuable message. And we can even see that David Lloyd George, the prime minister of Britain, became convinced by Bell's arguments during their in-person conversations. However, David Lloyd George was the prime minister in a grand coalition with the conservatives. And they occupied many of these powerful posts in the government. And they were the ones who were effectively blocking Winthrop Bell from taking the action that he wanted to take. And it was not because it was not always because they had fascist sympathies, although I do trace out in my book how one powerful figure who blocked Bell's reports did have fascist sympathies and was the architect of appeasement of Hitler and of the fascist in later years. But the predominant conservative interest was in drastically reducing spending. So increasing revenues and decreasing spending. What Bell was suggesting was that during this crisis, the government needed to temporarily increase spending in order to solve this German problem. Or else there would be another world war that would need to be fought in the future at a much greater cost than what it would be to take to rescue German democracy in 1919 and 1920.
Yeah, well, that's very helpful to explain to us. Now, in your book, actually, the title is "Cracking the Nazi Code," and code cracking sounds like a pretty classic spy terminology. What exactly is the code that Bell is cracking here?
Sure. Well, I'm kind of two codes. So the one is this code for that's being developed in 1918 and 1919 to fight World War II in what Winthrop Bell calls a generation in the future. So he says that in order to fight this next war, this extremist racist faction is going, they know that they need to rebuild their artillery and their navy, et cetera. And they needed to wait for the appearance of a new generation because the current fighting generation was so sick of war that they simply were not going to fight again. So there was this way in which this intention needed to be stated without there being clear authors attached to it. So I had given an example earlier of the unsigned propaganda saying kill the Jews and anti-Jewish newspapers that were coming out in 1919 that were advertising in these kind of oblique terms, who the enemy was and how they needed to be fought. So the code in that at that time was involved concealing the true authors of this, and also indicating that a fight was coming without being too obvious about it, because if they had been too clear about their intentions, Britain, France, and America would have squashed them. So they were needing to code their intentions by saying that they were going to be fighting communists. And what Winthrop Bell was saying in his reports later in 1919 was, in fact, this group was now getting along with the communists, the militant communists. So this was totally a ruse to cover up for the real reason for their militarization, which was going to be for race war. And then 20 years later, in 1939, Winthrop Bell published the first warnings of Hitler's plans for the Holocaust. The code that he interpreted there was from Hitler's Mein Kampf, along with statements from leading Nazi officials. And in one sense, this was the same as what had been going on in 1919, although now they needed to make the kind of the implications of their attack more blatantly obvious to their followers, but still to conceal it so it did not provoke opposition throughout the world. And so what Hitler did was, when he got to kind of the ultimate part of his program in Mein Kampf, the systematic extermination of all non-Aryan races on the earth, what he would do is he would speak in a historical code, which would point to historical instances of the wrong way to fight. And then he would point to these times in the Middle Ages when Germans would conquer a Slavic population, murder some people, but then calm down and intermarry with them. And Hitler said, well, that's the wrong way to fight. The right way to fight, he would point his readers to other times in these Slavic German wars in which the people were, the Slavs were systematically annihilated, further back historical examples like in Carthage, when the Romans simply just slaughtered the inhabitants of Carthage, including non-combatants. So what Hitler was telling his followers was, well, if you elect me, that's the way I'll fight, the right way and not the wrong way. But without ever bringing this into the present day in a way that when Western intelligence would have read this, they would have said, well, we really need to prepare to fight this guy because in the near future, he's going to be planning these racial exterminations. And I should just say here, it's you know, we don't usually think of this as a code, but that kind of awareness is just absolutely necessary. So it's not, so codes are not always, you know, these mathematical encryptions, which is I think what people tend to think of. But for instance, the Canadian general Roméo Dallaire, when he was trying to fight against the genocide that happened in Rwanda, he needed to be aware of these coded cultural terms. These were going out, you know, through the radio. Anybody could hear them. But these were designed so that somebody who could, say, just speak French but didn't know the context just wouldn't know what was being said. You needed to know that cultural context to know what these words meant, that, you know, cut down the tall trees meant, you know, kill the Tutsis. And even a person who had been fluent in French hearing this, not understanding that code, would have struck them as, you know, maybe, you know, like, you know, talking about cutting down, you know, timber or something for money. So I think this is a kind of code that, you know, we can forget about, but it's real. This is a real way that people communicate, and you know, nowadays we sometimes call this, you know, dog whistles, codes that are meant to be heard by a certain population, but are, you know, too acerbic or too dangerous, for the bad actors to be able to state these in plain language.
Yes, and I think we are still seeing those kinds of codes today in some of the conflicts that are going on. Now, when we look at the things that Winthrop Bell was warning about and the suggestions that he was making, and we don't want to go into too much detail about that because we want people to buy the book and and to find out. But do you personally think that there ever was a way in which the Allied powers could have responded to Germany in those interwar years in such a way that would have prevented the Second World War? Or was it something that was always destined to happen?
Absolutely. Well, so my book makes the argument that the Marshall Plan that follows World War II is Winthrop Bell's plan. So that's what he wanted to have happen in 1919 and 1920, and it didn't happen. It did happen in 1947, and the Marshall Plan brought Western and Central Europe, we're not now going on nearly eight decades of prosperity. And so that's what Winthrop Bell was telling the powers that be in 1919, that right now there is a critical mass of the population, of business leaders, of political leaders who desperately want friendship with the West. They want to get Germans to work. It will be profitable to Germany and to us if this happens. And all we need to do is to lend them a helping hand by getting them funding so that their businesses can get off the ground. Then they'll repay us that starting help, and they'll love us at the same time. So it's exactly what happened after World War II. And you know, nowadays we kind of think, well, you know, it was inevitable what happened after World War II, but in reality, it wasn't. So in 1947, Winthrop Bell was warning his friends in intelligence that once again, the Nazis were the strongest group within Europe, excuse me, within Germany. They were the strongest group within Germany. The Democrats were disorganized and demoralized. And what happened is that in the fullness of time is that the Marshall Plan was able to give German democracy hope and the ability to succeed. Absolutely, if that had happened in 1919, I'm totally convinced it would have worked, given what Winthrop Bell described, the pro-democratic sentiments, the fact that these racist militants were in the minority. There might have in 1919 been just a few thousand of them. They had effectively seized control of the German high command by that point, and that was something he was despairing about in the last months of 1919. But still, he was saying, you know, with the aid of the West, you know, and the fact that there were still, you know, pro-democratic military officers who could have been rehabilitated at that point, even though they've been kicked out of the military, like, we can still win this thing, but it's becoming more and more difficult as the military becomes more organized around this core of this vicious kind of racism.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's one of the things that really stuck with me in this book of the common sense and clear-headed suggestions that Bell was making, and how people were blinded either by a desire for revenge or afraid of what political bridges would be burnt by doing that. To think of how many lives could have been saved if they had listened. Now, as you did this research for this book, was there anything in particular that really stood out as surprising to you?
Sure. Well, I think, I mean, what was ultimately surprising to me is just how early the plans for World War II were being developed. So they're being created in 1915. And you know why so early? Well, it's because people like General Ludendorff understood the logistics of war. By that point, Germany's enemies were simply had more manpower and more industrial capabilities. The whole ability for Germany to have won World War I would have been to have succeeded in the first weeks of the war. They knew that they had the bigger military, and they had the element of surprise. So they were going to try to knock Paris out of the picture right away and you know, take what they wanted, owing to this powerful French and British defense. The lines got frozen up and it turned into attritional warfare. And at that point, it was, you know, virtually destined for you know, for the Allies to win, just because they had so much you know, more to supply. So Ludendorff, who's, you know he was, you know, not a wise man. But he was a clever man. In 1915, saw what was going to happen, and his notion was, you know, well, we can, you know, win the next war if we target the Jews first. But that was not going to be the end of it. So, you know, to my mind, this is, you know, it's surprising historically to realize that World War II was being planned in 1915. You know, far before Hitler had, you know, any influence whatsoever in Germany. But I think it's also, I think, a warning about racism in the present day. And I think there's a way in which, you know, racist bullies are going to, you know, try to pick on a small group first, but it's not going to end there. I think this is why, you know, we need to be nervous about, you know, rising tide of anti-Semitism, or, you know, whatever the group that's being targeted, the Tutsis or whomever. In this one way, the racists would like us to think that their aggression and their murders are going to be, you know, narrowly located to that group. But we find that that's not the case. It's going to spread, and that kind of greed and aggression is going to target other groups as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time Jason, to talk about Winthrop Bell and to share some of the information about this book. And again, I highly recommend it. It is a very good read. It totally fresh perspective, I thought, on some of the stuff that we don't realize. Sometimes we think that things are just beginning, maybe when Germany absorbs Austria or something like that, and you take us right back to where the origins are. Now, if people wanted to learn more about you and from you, are you present on social media or websites or anything like that?
Sure. Well, I should say I'm a professor at University of New Brunswick, so I have a website through UNB. I also have a personal website, jasonbell.org, and I have a website for the book called crackingthenazicode.com that talks about talks I'm going to be giving. I'll be going, for instance, on tour throughout the U.S. In the spring, summer, and fall.
Okay. Well, I will link to that in the show notes for sure. Well, thank you very much for taking the time, and I hope things go well in your research for your next book.
Thank you very much, Stephen. I'll look forward to our next conversation.
Yes. Take care.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.